Hi everyone, my name is Tahavit Schwartz, and this is Gefed on Daf Yomi, a joint project between Hadron and Yeshivat Jerusha. We are right now in the middle of the fourth parak of Bava Metzia, which deals with financial transactions and agreements between different parties. And the sugya that we'll be exploring together is the rabbinic concept of Mishapara, which really deals with the question of what does it mean to make a commitment to another person, a financial commitment to another person. What are the different ways or kinds of commitments that I can make? And what are the stakes of those commitments, both halachically, legally, and ethically or morally? We'll also be exploring the relationship between those questions, right? What are commitments that I make in transactions and their ramifications for the laws of Shomrim, right? What does it mean to make a commitment when I commit to guarding another person's object? Or another person's property, and right, how do those two questions go hand in hand? So let's jump right in. The Mishnah in Bava Metzia, the Perek Daled starts by asking really the question of when does, over the course of a transaction, right, there are a lot of stages to it. Haggle, come up with an agreement, the money changes hands, the object changes hands. So at what point in that process, do we really say that the transaction has taken place? In other words, at what point really has the commitment been made such that if one of the sides wants to go back on the deal, they can no longer do so? So as opposed to how we would think about it, probably in our day-to-day life and kind of modern economic context, according to halacha, the money changing hands, when I'm buying metatlin, so when I'm buying movable property, money changing hands is not enough to really affect a kinyan, for the transaction really to count. Instead, the buyer needs to take some kind of physical action with respect to the object that he is purchasing. So either picking it up, depending on what kind of object it is, pulling it. At that point, not when the money has changed hands, and not 48 hours after the transaction, but right, there's no refund within 48 hours according to halacha. But for the moment when the buyer has done some kind of physical action, bringing taking the object into his possession, right? If, on the other hand, I have just paid the money, the buyer or the seller can actually say, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to make the transaction in the end. But what we see at the end of this mission above Matzia here, right? Look at the bottom, Aval Amru, and but they said, it's not quite clear in the Mishnah who the they is. Mi shepara me'anshei dor ha'mavul midor ha'flaga hu atid lihipara mi she'ino omed b'dibura. But the one who exacted payment from the generation of the flood and the generation of the scattering, meaning the door of Migdal Bavel, right? He will exact payment from those who do not stand by their word, which is to say, sure, even if you've already agreed on a price, even if the money has already changed hands, one of the parties can still go back on the deal according to the letter of the law. Halachically, one can, and financially won't face consequences for it. The Mishnah is telling us that really, he will face consequences for it. Ethically and morally, it's the wrong thing to do. And really, God will exact payment on one who doesn't stand by their word. Now, what it looks like in the Mishnah here is that on the one hand, we have the legal, kind of the formal legal obligation, right, which kicks in only at a certain point. And beside that, we have an ethical or moral obligation that goes above and beyond the technical legal obligation, right? Beit Din can't necessarily do anything if you want to go back on your word up until a certain point, but if you want to go back on your word before that, we can still tell you that it's wrong. What we see in the Gemara is that Mishapara actually becomes in and of itself a sort of legal concept. There's a debate among the Amoraim of whether it's an oath or a curse, but it becomes something that the Beit Din can actually place on a person who doesn't want to stand by their word financially, which is to say, if the money's changed hands and then let's say the seller want to go back on the deal, I can do so. But the consequences are going to be that in court, they will make me accept the curse or the oath of what's called Mishapara. So we see already in the Gemara that This concept that really, according to the Mishnah, looks like it's like kind of a godic or just purely ethical concept actually starts to bear legal weight. That we want to give teeth to the notion that someone who makes a commitment, even if it's only a verbal commitment and it doesn't have real financial weight halachically, still is going to have real life consequences, even in this world. Now let's take a look at a couple of stories in the Gemara that emerge in our sugya on Daf Memtet that give us a little bit of a window into the context for this curse of Misha Para and the places where it might be important or relevant. So Hahu Gavra Diyahiv Zudeya Simsume Lusof Aikir Simsume. So what we see here is a transaction, right? Someone is going to buy sesame from the sellers and has already paid the money, but in the end, what ended up happening is that the price of the sesame went up, making it the case that the seller no longer wants, it's no longer a good deal, right? He could take it back and then sell it to someone else for a higher price. So what do they say? The sellers, they say, actually, we don't have sesame. Thought we did, but we don't. So take your money back and go home. So, right, what's going on here? It's a typical kind of financial situation. But on the other hand, it seems to include a lie, right? It's not that he doesn't have sesame. He just doesn't want to sell it for the price that he had initially agreed to. So it seems like the buyer doesn't believe him or doesn't want to go back in the deal. So what happens? Lo shakil zuzah. He actually, the buyer does not take back his money and leaves it with the sellers of the sesame until the money actually gets stolen. So, right, the dilemma that we have here is, okay, was the deal, was the seller really able to go back on the deal? And if he was able to go back on the deal, did he bear some kind of responsibility for the money that he's now holding on to? Has he become, in a sense, a shomer for the money, in which case would he be responsible for the theft? So Atila Kami to Rava, the two parties go before Rava to get judged on the case. And the Amarle cave unto Amri Lach Golzuzach Veloshak, the Loshak Yot, Lomibai Shomer Sachar de Lohavi, Ella Afilu Shomer Chinam Nami Lohavi. So Rava says, actually, this guy is not, the seller is not responsible for your money getting stolen. Why? He told you to take your money back. And you didn't take your money back. Problem is, it's on you. Amrulei Rabbanan Rava, but the rabbi said to Rava, "V'habai lik bulei le misha para." Amarlehu hachinami. So what did the rabbi say to Rava? Okay, sure, he's not responsible for having had to hold on to your money, but he is responsible. He does get misha para, doesn't he? Right. This the seller of the sesame chose to go back on the deal at a point when he had already taken money from the other party. So shouldn't he at least have to accept the curse? And what does Rava say? Yep, that's true. He does. He does have to take on Misha Para. Sure, he's not responsible as a shomer for the money, but he is responsible on some level for the fact that he went back on his word. And therefore, even though technically, legally, he could, he does still have to accept Misha Para. So what do we get from this story? Number one, right, not only agreement to a transaction, but even accepting the cash for it doesn't really obligate me in making the transaction, right? The deal has not actually been made and he could go back on it, but it does obligate in Misha Para. That's number one. And number two is that simply having another person's cash in my possession does not inherently make me responsible for watching over it. All right, we're going to see another story that looks very similar, but is slightly different. And we'll pay attention to the similarities and differences between the story and see what we can glean from those. So, story number two. Amar of Papi, Amar li Ravina, Lididi, Amar li Haomir Rabbanan, Rav Tavut Shemei, or Rav Tavut Shemei, Amar la Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra Shemei. So, story happened in the name of one of two people, either Rav Tavut or Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra. And what do we know about this person? What was true of this person? Ihavu Yabile Kol Chalala de Alma Lohavi Kamishane Bidibure. This is a very trustworthy person. What does the Gemara say about him? That, or what does Rav Papi say about him? That if you were to offer him the whole expanse of the world, he wouldn't go back on his word. So this was, right, either Rav Tavut or Rav Shmuel Bar Zutra was known for being extraordinarily trustworthy and extraordinarily a man of integrity. Now, what was the story that happened to Rav Shimon? To let's call him Rav Tavud for now, but he did have a uvda, right? This is what happened to me. How yoma afnei demali shabta hava v'hava yativna v'ata hahu gavra v'kayabav. So it was Erev Shabbos. Not only was it Erev Shabbat, it was the evening of Erev Shabbat. So really, we're cutting it close to Shkia. And I was sitting, and this person comes and right comes and stands in the gate. Amarle itlach shimshmei lizvune. Right, he says, "Do you have sesame to sell?" Amarle lo, and I said, "No, I don't have any." Amarle li havu hanach zuze b'pikadon gabach dehachashkali. Okay, the buyer or the person who wants to buy the sesame that Rav Tavut doesn't have says, okay, but it's Erev Shabbat and the sun's setting and I'm carrying all this money. Can I leave it with you? Because I don't want to have to be carrying money on Shabbat. To which Rav Tavut responds, ha beita kamach, my house is before you. In other words, yeah, sure, leave it there. But the words ha beita kamach are going to be important. So odvina beveita v'ignuv. The buyer or the person who wants to buy puts the money in his house, and lo and behold, the money gets stolen. Now to the Kamid Rava, Amar le kol habeit kamach, lo mi bai shomer sachar lo havi, ela afilu shomer chinam nami lo havi. So again, they come to Din Torah before Rava, who says the same thing that he said in the story before, right? The phrase habeit kamach doesn't render you a shomer, doesn't render you a guardian of, doesn't, Rav Tavut has no responsibility for the money that was left in his house. Not a shomer, not only is he not a shomer sachar, not even a shomer chinam, not responsible for the money getting stolen. So then they said to Rava again, but okay, sure, he doesn't get he's not responsible for the money getting stolen, but does he have to accept misha para? The Amarli lohi udvarim me'olam. And what does Rava respond? Nope, no misha para. It doesn't lohi udvarim me'olam. Basically, nothing happened. Rav Tavut bears no responsibility, not for the money, not for the money getting stolen, not for the transaction that didn't take place. So, right, what do we see from this story that looks a little bit different from the previous one? So, agreement to guard something or sort of hold it in your property doesn't obligate you. It obligates you neither as a shomer as a shomer. Nor does it give you any kind of responsibility of accepting Misha Para. So Rashi actually, the way that he reads the Sugya, he reads them as not as two separate stories, but as two different versions of the same story. Right? Oto ma'aseh d'sum simin al yadi haya v'lo chen haya. So right, what does Rav Tavut come to say? That story that you just saw, the anonymous story about the sesame seller, that story actually happened to me, and the details weren't right. This is how it happened. So right, Rashi thinks that the way that Rav Tavut is telling the story is actually a correcting of the narrative of the previous story. But either way, whether it's right two separate stories or Rav Tavut is fixing the girsa really of the previous story, right? Rav Tavut is correcting the details, which means that the differences between the details of the story are important. So let's just look at the way that the two stories play out. Right. So in the first version of the story, right, what kind of introductory information, what preconceived notions do we have about the characters involved? First story, anonymous guy, we don't know anything. And the second story, right, what we know about Rav Tavut is that even if you were to offer me the whole world, I wouldn't go back on my word, right? We know that he is extraordinarily trustworthy and that he stands by his word. What happens in the transaction, according to in the first story, right? There's a sort of normal economic incentives is what's going on here, right? We make an agreement, I get paid the money, but then the price goes up and I decide that I don't want the deal. Second story, Rav Tavut seems to really not have had the thing that the buyer wanted to buy. What happened with the Shmira? So in story number one, the money is in the seller's house and he tells the buyer to take it back, but the buyer refuses to. Whereas in story number two, Rav Tavut actually seems to really offer that the buyer leave the money on his property. He seems to whether the question of whether he's taking responsibility is more of a live question because he really gives the person permission. But what is, right, really, what is the conclusion of the story? In story number one, the seller gets Misha Para, in that he really seems to have made a commitment and then not lived up to his end of it. And in the version of story number two, there really is no, according to Rava, at least, there is no commitment that Rav Tavuda has seemed to have backed out on or reneged on. And one of the things that I think the two different versions of this story come to teach us is that really the idea of Misha Para, right, the point of it, really is for stories that look a lot like story number one, right, where the incentives are financial, right, the way that our economic system is set up is always going to leave room for someone to try to take advantage, right? There's going to be a point of no return, sure, wherever we draw that line, there's always going to be a point earlier, and there are always going to be financial incentives, lakan or lakan, right? The price is going to go up, the price is going to go down. And no matter what, there's always going to be room for people to go back on their word, to trick people, right? In story number one, theoretically he could have gone back on his word earlier, but no, he decided to lie, to say that he didn't have Simsumin, because on some level he didn't want for there to have been a pogrom in his credibility. And it's cases like that, really, when the curse of Misha Para becomes relevant, when the financial incentives cause us to be dishonest with one another. Whereas in story number two, right, that's not what's going on. We have two parties who really are trying to do good by one another, right? One of them, Rav Tavut, wouldn't go back on his word and he agrees to take responsibility for another person's money as a sort of favor. And in that case, Misha Para isn't really relevant. He didn't really go back on his word, not in any kind of significant way. Now, Tosfot on our sugya, and on the story of Rav Tavut, actually brings this into a conversation about the commitments of a shomer, and at what point the commitments of a shomer actually kick in, not only at what point in the course of the transaction, but actually what kinds of statements or what kinds of commitments entail taking on responsibility as a shomer, what renders someone a shomer, which also gets at the question of really what are the nature of interpersonal financial commitments according to halacha. So Tosfot looks at our sugya and looks at Rav Tavut and sees that actually there's a this seems to contradict a different sugya in Bava Metzia and Perakapar in Perakap sorry sugya in Bava Kama and Perakapara. Rav Hada Amar Perakapara Hichnis Birshut Balachatzer Chayav Rabbi Omer Adchi Kabela Balachatzer Shmira. So we see there's a machloket Tanaim in Bava Kama about what constitutes the commitment that a shomer takes on. So Tana Kama thinks that from the moment that an object kind of voluntarily enters my property, I am now chayav as a shomer, right? Meaning the moment I agree to let someone bring something onto my property, at that point, I'm a shomer. Rebbe, on the other hand, says that, no, I have to, some kind of explicit statement, right? Achi kabel alav bala chatzer shmira. There has to be some kind of explicit taking on responsibility as a shomer. So, right, we have shita of Tanakama and the shita of Rebbe. Tanakama, we theoretically would think that we would hold by Tanakama, but in our sugya here with Rav Tavut, he seems like hichnis birshut bala chatzer. It seems like the object, the money, entered his property voluntarily, right? The Rav Tavut agreed to it. So why isn't he responsible? Now, Tosfot brings two answers. Answer number one, Yesh lomar d'shma tein adya k'rebi. D'shmuel hatam psik hilchata k'rebi. Ma'alfa gav d'rav hatam psik hilchata k'tana kama, kaimelan k'shmuel b'dine l'gabe rav. So we see answer number one is maybe our sugya here with Rebbe, he just holds like Rebbe, right? We saw that this question is a machloket in Bava Kama, so maybe we just hold by the side that agrees that seems to agree with our Mishnah, right? We in Bava Kamma, the machloket between Rebbe and Tana Kamma ends up also being a machloket between Rav and Shmuel. Rav holds like Tana Kamma and Shmuel holds like Rebbe. And Tosfot says maybe our sugya holds like Shmuel, that we hold like Rebbe. In general, we hold like Shmuel on financial or civil law matters. So that's option number one, that even without any kind of explicit agreement, the Shomer has not taken on responsibility, and there needed to be some kind of explicit, yeah, sure, I will take on the role of a Shomer. Rav Tavu didn't do that, so he's not responsible. That's option number one. Option number two. Vod, dafu le rabbanan de mechayve, haynu lefisha amar le knos shorcha demashma veshmerenu, aval habeta kamach, right, salik atzmo mishmira legamri. Right, maybe Tosfot says number two, actually we do hold like Tana Kamma. Tana Kamma says that without any kind of statement to the contrary, if you bring an object onto my property with my permission, I have taken on the responsibility of a shomer. But even Tana Kamma would think that if I make an explicit statement that I don't want to take on the responsibility of a shomer, right, that sure, you can use my property for your own purposes, but I bear no responsibility for what happens to your stuff. In that case, I do not take on responsibility. And what does Tosfot do? Tosfot reads our sugya with Rav Tavut as the words ha beta kamach, right, my house is before you, use it as you wish, as an explicit as a way of explicitly not taking on the responsibility of a shomer, right? Explicit refusal to take on responsibility, right? Sure, you can use my house for what you want to do. And what Rav is saying in our sugya is that even Tana Kamma would say that he's not responsible in such a case. Rav Tavut is not responsible because he explicitly took himself out of the category of a shomer, right? What we see, right, these are Tosfot's two answers, two ways of making sense of the relationship between the two sugyot. So, and right, methodologically, what we see is the two different reads give us a different view of what I would call the neutral ground, in which I bring something into my responsibility, I bring something onto my property with kind of voluntarily, but don't make any explicit statement that I want to take on the one hand responsibility of shomer, and on the other hand, don't want to take on the responsibility of a shomer. Right, according to the first answer, which is at the bottom here, right, the halacha is in accordance with Rebbe, and the shomer's responsibility begins only when he takes upon himself explicit responsibility, right, and Rav Tavu didn't do that. Or on the flip side, right, we can read our sugya even according to Tana Kamma, and the reason why why Rav Tavu isn't responsible as a shomer is because he explicitly explicitly refused to take on responsibility, explicitly didn't make the commitment of becoming a shomer, right? So, right, really, what is required in order to become a shomer? We see, depending on how whether you go with the first or the second answer of Tosfot, a spectrum really of three different possibilities, right? The first is the kind of basic pshat read of Tana Kamma according to Tosfot's first read, which we wouldn't hold by. If no matter what happens, if the object enters your domain voluntarily. Right, and that Rav holds like Tana Kamma and would seem to contradict our sugya of Rav Tavu. Option number two, if the object enters your domain voluntarily without any explicit refusal to take on responsibility, right? So this is, according to Tosfot's second answer, this is what Tana Kamma meant all along, and that's what's happening in our sugya with Rav Tavu. Or the most kind of most extreme, most machmir position, right? I only take on the responsibility of a shomer if the object enters my domain voluntarily, and I explicitly agree that I'm willing to take on, right, Achi Kabel Ashura, and that I'm willing to take on the responsibilities of a shomer. That's Rebbe's position, and that's Rava's position with regard to Rav Tavot and our sugya, according to Tosfot's first answer. Right, so with all of that, right, what we start to see, right, again, different kinds of commitments land us in different places with regard to, on the one hand, transactions, and on the other hand, shmirah, right, the responsibility for another person's object that I take on, right? When am I responsible on the one hand for someone else's things that enter my property, and when on the other hand am I responsible, right? When can I no longer take back a deal that I've committed to? with regard to all of those, right, and we'll see also shortly that even with Shmirah too, there the concept of Mishapara, right, is also relevant, right? If I agree to watch another person's object, but even if, and then want to take it back, I might get Mishapara in that case as well. The final thing that we're going to look at is also with Dine Shmira, right? The question of at what point I can take things back and the question of at what point I'm responsible for the object itself, right? Those two things are actually both, right, live questions with regard to Shmira, and we were looking at them as kind of almost the same question, right? When does the transaction really take place? But we'll see here in a sugya in on Daf Tzadi Tet that actually those two notions can really come apart. So what we're going to be talking about here is a case of a shoel, or but it a case of a shoel, which is a person's borrowing another object, one of the kinds of shomrim, one of the different kinds of guardians of an object, who has the highest level of responsibility with regard to the object that he's watching because he is allowed to use the object. And here too, the Gemara is going to ask the question of at what point does that commitment become halachically firm? And we're going to see a machloket amoraim. Amar Rav Huna, hashoel kardom mechaveiro, bakabo knao, lo bakabo, lo knao. So Rav Huna says someone who is borrowing an axe from his fellow, what is the point at which the kinyan has taken place? Not when the money has changed hands, although there isn't really money here because he's borrowing it, but not when he has brought the object onto his property, not necessarily when he has picked up or pulled the object, but from the moment that he has started to use it, bakapa, when he has chopped wood with it, at that point he has purchased it. Before that, he has not. So that's now we're seeing a kind of third category than we saw before, lemai. So the first option that they bring up is, right, what does it mean, kno? At what point does he become responsible for the object if it gets lost, stolen, something happens to it, even in a case of onus, a shoel, a borrower is chayav. So that's the first option. The Gemara rejects it. Ela l'chazara, bakabo lo matzi hadar b'mashil, lo bakabo matzi mashil hadar. Rather for chazara, for the question of can I take it back, or can the lender go back on his word? So the maskana of the Gemara is that the moment at which point the lender can no longer go back on his word isn't when the shoel takes it onto his property, but is when he starts using it for his own practical purposes. Seems like, right, according to Rav Huna at least, onsin, right, the responsibility for the object actually, right, begins at an earlier point when I bring it onto my property, or right at the point when I would make the kinyan meshicha through some kind of physical action with regard to the object. But even when I'm already responsible for making sure that nothing bad happens to the object, the mashil, the lender, can still go back on his word up until the very last moment, up until I've started to use it. We're going to see the opinion that disagrees. Pliga Rabbi Elazar, Damar Rabbi Elazar, Kederach Shetiknu Meshicha B'Lekuchot, Kach Tiknu Meshicha B'Shomrim. Just as Meshicha, pulling, or some kind of physical movement of the object is the way to be kona any object in with normal financial transactions, same thing with Shomrim. Right, that's how it works. That's the moment when you can no longer take it back. So, right, if just to review, until when can the lender go back on his agreement to lend the object? According to Rav Huna, until the moment that the borrower begins to use the object. According to Rabbi Elazar, until the moment that the borrower, right, pulls the object into his domain, the same way that buying and selling objects works. Right, what we see here is that even though, as we saw, with Misha Para, right, there's inherent ethical, moral, and even on some level, legal obligation that comes from the moment that I've made a commitment. But, right, technically, legally, right, the moment when I can go back on my word, right, doesn't come until some later point. What we see here that's really fascinating is that the technical legal obligation even gets pulled apart within the world of Shomrim. Right, on the one hand, I can be responsible for a shomer. There are really two things going on. On the one hand, I'm taking responsibility for your object. I've decided to watch it, and I've agreed to watch it, and now I'm responsible for what happens to it. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, it's also it's a transaction of sorts, right? In a case of a socher, I'm paying you money in order to be able to use your object. In a case of she'ela, borrowing, right? I'm not paying you money, but I get benefit from this agreement too. I can use your object. And one of what's so fascinating about this picture is that, right, those two elements of the transaction actually come apart, right? According to Rav Huna, at least according to Rav Huna, right, the moment when I take responsibility for watching your object, sure, that's whenever that is, whether I pull it into my domain. But the moment at which the transaction takes place, right, the moment at which now the object is mine to use and you, the lender, can't do anything about it, that doesn't happen until the moment that I've started to use the object. We don't have time to look at these inside, but what we're going to see is that there's actually a debate among the Rishonim and the Acharonim about which kinds of Shomrim which kinds of guardians this question applies to, right? And it might depend on, right, where really can those notions come apart, right? On the one hand, my responsibility for your object for making sure that nothing bad happens to it. On the other hand, our transaction, the deal that we're making between the two of us, at which point can we no longer go back onto it? Aren't the, right, with Shmirah in general, one would think, no, those two things are actually inextricably bound up with one another, right? On the one hand, right, I'm on some level able to use your object because I agreed to watch it. So shouldn't those two things go together? Not necessarily, right? On the question of my benefit from your object on the one hand and your benefit from my, I guess, agreement to watch it, my responsibility for your object, might come apart in certain cases. And there's machloket between Tosfot and the Drisha about whether that refers specifically to cases, to the kinds of Shomrim who are able to benefit from the object itself, whether that refers to any Shomer who is getting benefit at all, even if he's getting paid in order to just watch the object that he isn't allowed to use. But in all these cases, right, what the Rishonim really are asking or are wondering about is the relationship between the different kinds of commitments that really are taking place when I agree to become a Shomer. The commitment that I'm making to you to watch your object, the commitment that you're making to me that this deal is going to go through and you will be able to, and I'll be able to have benefit from the object. And as with, right, this whole sugya with Misha Para and the question of the commitments of a Shomer, right, we really do see the halakha contending with the question of at what point my commitments really take effect. And as we move into Pesach, right, a holiday about really in large part about the power of our words, this power of telling stories, thinking about the power of our words also in context of financial agreements, we can... We can use this sugya as an opportunity to think really more carefully about saying only what we mean and really standing by what we say. Chag Sameach, and see you next week.